This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, March 16th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. Rape is among the worst crimes one can commit. And yet police departments have massive backlogs of untested rape kits that could provide evidence in those cases. How is it possible that police seem less than interested in solving these violent crimes? Clark Neely, Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute, comments.
This has been a problem both in my home state of Kentucky. It's a problem in Virginia. It's a problem in North Carolina. And I assume it's a problem in many other states. And that is rape kits, sometimes the only piece of information that police have to identify a rapist, go untested. And at least in one case in Virginia, one rape kit went back to the 80s in terms of, and it just sit there. And I can't imagine why.
Yeah, it seems to be a real problem, this sort of epidemic of untested rape kits. It is difficult to understand how this could possibly happen. It's such a serious crime. It's oftentimes involving, serial rapists. So it's incredibly important that the person be identified and prosecuted and taken off the street. And all I can think of is that it's a question of incentives. It seems that rape cases are particularly difficult. It can be a real challenge just to identify the perpetrator and then to get a conviction. And perhaps it's the case that police are reluctant to investigate these cases or put less emphasis on them because they're more challenging.
So when you consider what I assume is the public outcry for or I should say public outrage when the public learns that rape kits are going untested and presumably rapists are not being identified. Is it possible at least that maybe police don't test rape kits because the likelihood of identifying some sort of random rapist is very low, and maybe spending the resources on testing those rape kits is unlikely to yield much benefit?
That sounds to me like a rationalization at best and perhaps even a cop-out. Yes, some of the results will come back in a way that's unhelpful. In other words, there won't be there is this national database of of DNA that they can compare the results against. And of course, sometimes you won't get a hit. But the idea that that would somehow make it pointless or bad use of resources, I think is untenable. And of course, we have to go back to the seriousness of the crime. This is one of the most serious crimes that you can commit, that can be committed. And the idea that not just one or two, but apparently many police departments are insufficiently motivated to follow through and at least make an effort to determine the identity of the person who is alleged to have committed the crime is perplexing.
Yeah, because it would seem that the incentives on one side, which is a public backlash against departments clearly not doing a job that they've committed to doing, has to be a very strong reaction. So the whatever incentive is causing police departments to not focus on this or not make this a priority in these cases has to be very strong as well.
Well, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Police and prosecutors are like anybody else. They respond to incentives. One of the most shocking figures I've encountered since I've been doing criminal justice work here at Cato is that in 2016, there were more arrests for marijuana-related offenses than for all violent crimes combined. I find that a shocking figure. On one hand, it's shocking. But on the other hand, if you think about the incentives in play, of course it's easier to arrest somebody and presumably to convict them for drug-related offenses. And of course, hiding in all of this or not hiding in all of this, but it's important to remember that probably there's a much greater likelihood that when you take down someone who's selling drugs, that they'll have some cash that you can take, or a car, or a house. So you've got the specter of civil forfeiture, further warping incentives. Presumably, most rapists don't have a whole closet full of cash the way some people who sell drugs might. And so we look at all of the incentives that come to play here and may not be some, huge, mismatch or the incentives maybe aren't all that strong. Maybe it's enough that they're just there at the margin. And if you wake up one day and say, hey, what should I investigate today? You'll maybe it's easier to do your job if you're just going after some drug dealer or alleged drug dealer than trying to close a cold rape case. And maybe that's all there is to it.
What function, just so everybody's clear, what function do rape kits perform?
Well, they enable you to do a couple things. First, to determine whether there is any DNA material on the victim. That can be obviously that can be semen, but that can also be skin under the fingernails or toenails or hair, things like that. So essentially what you're able to determine is whether or not the alleged attacker left any DNA material behind. And if so, you can compare that the DNA against other DNA that you already have in some local or federal database. And it's not, from what I understand, it is not uncommon to get a match. And then, of course, you know at least who the person is. Now, it's also the case that in many instances of where there's been an alleged rape, the victim already knows who the perpetrator is. And so in those, and there may be not even any dispute that they had sexual contact. So in those cases, there may be some rationale for not going to the expense, not, you know, incurring the expense of testing the rape kit. But that's not – that doesn't appear to be what's going on here. It's not the case that there's sort of, you know, some conscious choice to not test the rape kits where there wouldn't be any point. It seems to be just across the board there's a backlog of – a tremendous backlog of these kits. But that could be one reason.
You have to assume that with thousands of untested rape kits, some of those may have been not tested for the reasons that you just talked about. Some of them have to have been not tested where, one, they would get a hit. Two, it would be clear who the person was. That person probably has a driver's license and an address. And so there's no other explanation but negligence for at least some of these.
That certainly seems to be the case, or at least insufficient incentives to properly and completely investigate these cases, which of course would include testing the rape kit unless there is some strong reason not to. And it is true. I mean, and sometimes they're able to resolve the case without testing the kit. They know who was involved and they're able to resolve the case in some other way. So there may be reasons to not test a particular kit, but that's not, again, what's going on here. This is just a failure across the board to test, you know, thousands and thousands of rape kits, not because there's been some determination that there would be no point. And again, it's impossible to imagine that the officers involved don't care or that they don't think this is important. It really strikes me that this has got to be a question of incentives, and there's just insufficient there's an insufficient incentive for them to follow through and complete the testing on these rape kits. And it's good that there's been this backlash. It's good that there's been a pushback. It's good that legislatures are becoming aware of the breadth of this problem and the intensity of people's anger that this very fundamental step in an investigative process is not being taken. And so there's been reaction. There have been some legislatures that have committed more money to it. There's a law that was passed in Virginia that mandate the testing of all rape kits within a certain amount of time. And so progress is being made, but it's astonishing we got to the point that we did.
Is there any price to be paid by individual departments or chiefs of police or individual officers for not undertaking this important task?
No, and it fits perfectly within our near zero accountability policy for law enforcement. We have in this country what amounts to a near zero policy of non-accountability for law enforcement, and this fits perfectly well within that. No one's going to lose their job over this. Probably no one's been demoted over it. And unfortunately, that's just part of a pattern of non-accountability in law enforcement, which is, in my judgment, one of the single most important things in criminal justice reform today is the overall lack of accountability by actors within the system, whether they're engaged in deliberate misconduct, deliberate excessive use of force against a restrained prisoner, for example, which we see far too often, or simple negligence or indifference, as in this case. But somebody ought to be held to account. Almost always no one is held to account, and that's a problem that certainly needs to be addressed on a more systemic level.
Clark Neely is Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.